of those who have invited us and made this retreat possible, and also to thank all of you very much for having the sufficient interest to attend. Although we're using this word seminar, I'd like at the beginning to make sure that you put out of your mind the idea of sitting in a classroom in a university or a college, because we don't want to, or I don't want to look at the text and the sutta that we are going to consider with a kind of detached attempt at objectivity, as though we were analyzing these teachings with a kind of disinterest. This is a retreat. We are incorporating the practice of these ideas in our own lives. So we'll be exploring ideas, but at the same time reflecting on what those ideas mean, not in a general sense, but what they mean for you and me now. To try during this weekend not to create the separation between concepts that might at some level be quite abstract, maybe even a little difficult to grasp, from the actual lived experience of breathing, of feeling our bodies, noting our sensations, our thoughts, our responses, our reactions, our anxieties, our worries, our joys. The Buddha did not teach in order to construct a perfect theory of how the world works or what the nature of reality is. The Buddha was essentially, I think, a pragmatist. He was interested in ideas and values and exercises that could actually affect the quality of our conscious experience here and now. So we'll be interleafing talks, discussions with periods of formal sitting meditation and walking meditation, and also, of course, with the practice of noble silence that will hopefully support the meditation, the awareness, the mindfulness, will allow us to go a little bit deeper into our experience than we would perhaps normally do in the course of a study program. So we have to try and find a balance between an intellectual interest and perhaps an analytical inquiry into ideas, and at the same time an openness to what these ideas mean in the context of our own lives. So that'll be the kind of framework that we will try and hold as the teachers. And we'll have plenty of time for discussion, for questions and answers, so it won't just be lots of you having to listen to what Martin and I have to say. And of course, since probably for most of you English is not your native language, if you have difficulty with any word or term that Martin and I are using, then please, you know, put up your hand and say, what does that mean? And someone can translate it if need be. Likewise, if our accents or our way of expressing things is not clear to you, then please make that known to us as well. The whole thing is being recorded. I think one of these is the Torvana recorder, is that correct? Yeah? So I don't know what that means, but I suspect it means they'll be available later in some form. Okay, so, and they'll be streamed, will they? So you can just listen to them on the computer. So, in other words, everything that we say, including what I just said now, will be hearable again on the website after the retreat. If you want to take notes, please do so. There's no problem with that. But again, just be careful, as with any activity, not to get somehow compulsively drawn into it. I remember when I was studying many years ago in India, when I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk. We didn't have tape recorders in those days, or we certainly didn't have these little beautiful things. We had rather dilapidated Indian school exercise books, and in which we frantically tried to write down everything that the teacher said. And in retrospect, when I look back on that, I think there was a certain element of possessiveness, trying to possess, trying to hold on to secure this information in a way that it would then somehow be available, it would be mine. So to look out for that habit of mind, if you are in any way prone to it, and to recognize that an attitude of openness, an attitude of presence, an attitude of curiosity and interest, does not mean that you have to remember everything that is said. I would trust in the fact that you will recall and you will remember what is somehow significant for you. There may be a lot that's said that you don't really need to think about much. But try to, in a sense, listen in the same way that we would also meditate, with a stillness and an openness of mind. This evening, I want to just lay the broad field of ideas that I want to explore through the next couple of days, to put it in a context. And that context is that in which the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, the context in which he taught, the context of ideas that were already present at his time. One sometimes has the impression when you read these Buddhist texts that the Buddha is simply enunciating these great truths that come from the direct depths of his own enlightenment, his own awakening, and that these words that issue forth from his mouth are somehow independent of the culture, the beliefs, the worldview, the different philosophical ideas that were going on around him. I think the very central idea of the Buddha Dhamma, which is that of dependent or conditional arising, that everything comes into being out of other circumstances and conditions and does not exist in some sort of self-existent way in and of itself, but that our whole experience, the whole way in which life and the world unfolds, is one that emerges out of a complexity of relationships. And that is equally true of the Buddha's own teaching. He's not speaking in a vacuum, but he's speaking to people who have been brought up and who have adopted certain views about themselves and the world, some of which are inherited from tradition, others of which may simply be in the air at the time. We don't really know. We have to remember that we're also talking about events that took place a very long time ago. Maybe not so long in terms of Jewish tradition, but nonetheless, 2,500 years have passed since these ideas were first introduced, and obviously, you know, a great deal has gone on since then that has modified and perhaps colored and given different shades of meaning to these ideas. And Buddhist traditions, whether they be the Theravada or the Zen or the Tibetan traditions, have developed these ideas in their own ways. And when we read a book on Buddhism, we have to be aware, I think, that what we're getting is something that is often a product of history and time, again, delivered in a context quite different to that in which the Buddha spoke. If you read, say, a Zen text, you have to take into account Chinese or Japanese or Korean tradition and history, and the situations of Buddhist monks in the, let's say, the 12th century, the 8th century in China or Japan. It's very difficult to disentangle all of the influences, all of the elements that have gone into a particular Buddhist teaching or idea. So I don't pretend in the next 2 days to be able to tell you, well, this is what the Buddha said and this is what he was really focused on. I think that would be way too arrogant. I certainly have to acknowledge my own ignorance. I've been studying and practicing these ideas for quite some time, about 40 years. But in some ways, the more that I look into these teachings and ideas, the more I become aware of how little I know and of how little I understand. One of the great beauties of a classical text in any tradition, and of course we have our own traditions which we find in the Bible, for example, and what makes a text somehow worthy of this kind of investigation is that it somehow manages to survive its the time in which it was given and continues to speak across generations, across cultures, to the condition of human beings in different places at different times. And so we find that in all of the great religious traditions, every generation will have its own struggle to understand these texts. Each generation will hear these ideas in a way that speaks to their particular condition, but at the same time there is something rather universal that we find in these texts, and that's precisely what gives them life, allows them to survive. And I never cease to be surprised reading a Pali text which may be as old as 2,500 years, and yet to feel that it is speaking to me. I wouldn't have the same experience, for example, if I read an Egyptian or an ancient Egyptian text about the god Horus, for example. I have a feeling when I do read those sort of materials, I don't feel that I'm somehow being spoken to directly. The symbology might be very interesting. It may have all sorts of interesting associations, but I don't feel that that text is somehow addressing directly my own condition. But when I read a classical Buddhist text, not all of them, but a great deal of them, I feel that what is being said is somehow timeless. There's something that seems weirdly contemporary, weirdly exact, not in an historical sense, but in a direct, felt sense here and now. So what I'm going to be doing over the next couple of days is to try to single out what is distinctive in what the Buddha said. What is it in these early texts of the Pali Canon that distinguished the Buddha's teaching from what was already current, was already understood at the time in which he lived? So in order to do that, we have to have some sense of how people at the Buddha's time saw the world. What kind of picture did they have of what the human being was? And what kind of cosmos, what kind of universe the human being inhabited? I want to focus on one particular body of teachings that was the only one really we have that has come down to us, of teachings that were already in existence at the Buddha's time. And they are found in a group of writings which I'm sure many of you have heard of, if not actually studied and read yourselves, called the Upanishads. The Upanishads are a collection of, they consist mainly of verses. A lot of them are written in the form of a dialogue. And they are very much about how to achieve a certain kind of freedom, a certain kind of liberation. And they present ways of spiritual practice whereby such liberation can be gained. Now the question, of course, is liberation from what? What is it that people sought to be freed from? And how was that to be achieved? So the broad picture of the world that informs the Upanishads is a world in which living beings, not just human beings, but other forms of life as well, find themselves in a state of existence, let's say the human existence, and this is something that is understood to be the result of previous actions or karma committed in previous existences, previous lifetimes, and that the actions that one continues to commit in this life will likewise serve as the driving force, the moral force, that determines the quality of life, the quality of existence that you will experience after death, in your next life. In Buddhism, this is very similar to many teachings in Buddhism, which speaks of the six realms of existence, for example, and which has quite a more sort of highly worked out theory of the law of karma, of cause and effect, moral cause and effect. But at the time of the Upanishads, this was not so clearly worked out. There was the general idea that your existence in this world is the result of your former actions, and your destiny after death will likewise be the consequences of what you do in this life, or, of course, also actions which still remain unrealized from previous existences. So we have the basic framework of the idea of reincarnation or rebirth and karma, and that is what keeps the process of birth and death continuing in a way infinitely, without end, without beginning. But the purpose of the spiritual traditions of the Upanishads is to find a way to break free from this suffering cycle of birth and death, and thereby not be born again, and thereby have to die again, but rather to find a way to achieve a liberation and freedom from that condition. Now, the very word Upanishad means something like a teaching which is whispered to somebody who is sitting close by you. It means to sit close by. And the idea is that of the realized yogin or spiritual teacher or master, who will transmit to the well-developed student, and again only certain people of good moral and noble and spiritual character are considered appropriate for this teaching, that the teacher will pass this on to the chela, in other words the guru and the disciple. That's the key relationship. And through practicing what the guru has taught, then the disciple too can reach the same kind of realization and liberation that the guru himself has achieved. Now, this process is based upon accepting two fundamental ideas. One is the idea of Brahman, which we can loosely translate as God, but it doesn't have much to do at all with the monotheistic idea of God. Brahman is an impersonal, absolute, transcendental reality that is beyond any feature of the sensible or the observable or the experienced world that we know, and yet is also the source, the very foundation, the very ground from which this world arose. And we find in the Upanishads, in some of the Upanishadic texts, quite detailed descriptions of the sequences of creation, cosmogony, how the cosmos, the ordered world, came into being out of this unconditioned ultimate ground called Brahman. I'm not going to get into any of that now. You can read it in the Upanishadic texts later if you wish. But the basic idea is that Brahman gave rise to this world, created this world, and then the created beings became deceived and confused by it and began to identify themselves with their bodies, with their possessions, with their minds, with their thoughts, and lost touch with their true self, which in essence is identical to God, to Brahman. And this true self is called the Atman. We can just translate it here as self, or spirit if you wish. Atman is related to the word for breath. So the yogin seeks to break free from the cycle of confusion and suffering and birth and death by reconnecting, by re-identifying with what is in fact his or her truest nature, their innermost self, which shares the same attributes as God, as the divine. And the way in which the Upanishads teach this process is essentially through one of a disidentification with the sensible world, the experienced world. Perhaps the most famous way in which this is presented is in the idea of neti-neti. In other words, whenever you become aware of some object of consciousness, you say, it is not this, or I am not this, I am not this, I am not that, I am not those things, I am not these thoughts, I am not this body, I am not these feelings, I am not these sensations. And one thereby progressively disassociates oneself from thinking of oneself as a body, as a series of thoughts or something in the world, and through this process, by turning the attention progressively inwards, one becomes more and more attuned and open to this fundamental reality of what is sometimes called pure consciousness, pure knowing. We find it in the expression of Sat, Chit, Anand, truth, consciousness, bliss. That is in fact one's most true nature, which is identical to that of God. So that if at death you are able to die in that state of mind, that state of consciousness, you will achieve through that divine mystical union, liberation from the trauma of repeated and endless birth and death. Now, although that is, I mean, that is very, very rough account. If you look at the text, you'll see that there are different ways in which that's presented. But that, I think, is the basic idea. Now, this idea also, it's worth bearing in mind, is not an idea that was the exclusive to the Brahmins in India. It appears that that basic picture of the world, of actions and rebirth, different realms of existence, and so on, and also the idea of freeing oneself from that cycle, you find also throughout much of the ancient world in which the Buddha would have lived, all the way through to Greece. A very good example of that way of thinking is found in one of Plato's dialogues called the Phaedo, which is the Plato's account of the last days and the death of his teacher Socrates. And Socrates, as he reflects on his forthcoming death, he's asked by his students, you know, how can you face death with such amazing equanimity and without any fear? And Socrates' answer in the Phaedo is very, very similar to the sort of ideas we find in the Upanishads. He says that it's through not identifying with my body, through allowing myself to be open to the presence of God, and by trusting in that rather than being identified with anything physical or material or worldly, that I find this equanimity in the face of death and I have nothing to fear. Again, that is something you can look at. It's section 65 onwards from the Phaedo of Plato. But we find the same ideas also in the schools of Pythagoras. In other words, we must be careful not to think that the Buddha inhabited a religious and a cultural world that was exclusively that of the Indian subcontinent. This was a worldview that was spread far more widely than that. Exactly where it began is still a matter of debate. It's possible that these ideas did originate in India, but we don't really know. The point is that this was a very common way of seeing the world at that time. Another point is worth bearing in mind is that the Upanishads are also called the Vedanta. And Vedanta means the culmination or the end, anta, of the Vedas. The Vedas were those early Indian hymns very often. They were, in a sense, praises of different gods, supplications to the gods for the world to prosper, which became very much the work of the Brahmin priests in India. And as the time developed, probably in the 1,000 or so years before the Buddha, then some of the ideas that were implicit in the Vedas began to be taken up and explored in a more philosophical way. So the Upanishads are the culmination of Vedic thought, in that here we find the Indian yogins and other thinkers and priests were really beginning to work out the implications of Vedic thought and to develop what in theology is called a soteriology, a theory of salvation, a theory of liberation. Now the Buddha taught in a world that was very much informed by these kinds of ideas. And as I'm sure when I was speaking, many of you would have been quite familiar with these ideas, not necessarily from your readings of the Upanishads, but simply from many teachings that are found in Buddhism itself. The idea of rebirth, of karma, liberation, and so forth and so on. All of these are familiar in Buddhism as well. So, if we want to ask what was different in the Buddhist teaching, what was it about what this man Siddhartha Gautama said that was so striking, that was perhaps even slightly shocking, that his disciples and his followers over the next centuries made considerable effort, and in fact it's quite remarkable that they did this, to actually remember what he said, that they made a collective effort to preserve the teachings of this man. Remember that there were many other non-orthodox teachers who were contemporary with the Buddha. He wasn't just the only one who was saying anything of this nature. He lived at a time of considerable political, economic, social, and religious turmoil and change. Again, I don't have time to get into all of this in any great detail, but it is, I think, important to note that the Buddha was born at a time in which very fundamental changes were taking place in the nature of Indian society. The system of governance was breaking down from its traditional way of small tribal clans and other confederations of tribes living in small communities, a bit like the early Greek republics, in which the life of the society was governed by groups of elders. They were oligarchies, but they were small-scale agricultural communities served spiritually by the Brahmin priests, who maintained harmony with the gods, provided security for the growth of crops and so on, ruled by the Katya, or the Kshatriyas, the ruling classes, the nobility, with beginnings of merchant activity, and then of course with many workers, and also of course it was a slave society. There were slaves involved as well. But at the Buddha's time, that system was in a way coming to an end and was being replaced by the emergence of monarchy. The first great kingdoms of India were coming into being at that time. And this was made possible because of the economics of the Gangetic Basin at that period, which had moved into a time when there was the generation of surplus. In other words, the agrarian culture and economy was now sufficiently robust and secure that it was producing more than people needed for simply staying alive. And that surplus is what enabled two things. It enabled kings or rulers or powerful strong men to recruit standing armies. In other words, able-bodied men who did not have to work in the fields but could be trained in the arts of war, and that would enable these people to begin to expand their territory and secure it through armed force. But at the same time, this surplus, this economic surplus, also allowed other young men and women, maybe elder men and women too, to not have to work from dawn to dusk, but they could be free to pursue what we would call a life of the mind, a spiritual life, a religious life, a philosophical life. And they could survive by begging. They were not, they didn't have to work. There was enough surplus so that they could once a day go into the village whereby they were staying. They could beg alms, which of course still exists in Buddhist countries today, and thereby have enough to survive on, enough food to survive on, and to be able then to pursue philosophy, meditation, religious inquiry, and so on. So this economic surplus was very, very crucial to the whole development of the spiritual and religious life of the time, and also, of course, to the political structures and the social structures that were likewise transforming. As soon as kings and rulers were able to create larger states, this gave rise to the emergence of the first cities, which was also something that was occurring only really at the Buddha's time, or in the few decades, maybe a century or so before. And the Buddha's teaching, his communities were based, his main ones were all based in close proximity to the emerging urban centers of India, Rajagaha, Vaishali, and Savatthi being the principal ones. So the Buddha, in a sense, was addressing a society that was undergoing some fairly radical transformations. It was enabling forms of mercantile activity, trade and commerce, which were generating unknown levels of wealth and prosperity in these cities. Many of the Buddha's great benefactors were bankers, very successful merchants who funded his whole operation, if we can put it as crudely as that. And the kings, or the Maharaja, the great rulers, were able to provide him with security. In other words, the areas within the domains around these cities were safe. We often have the idea that the Buddha and his monks would wander off into the mountains and just meditate and so on, but that of course is quite untrue. Certainly the Buddha encouraged his monks to go to remote places and meditate, but the actual driving centers of these monastic lifestyles was based in the communities in proximity to the main cities. And there were other teachers like the Buddha, the most famous of whom of course is Mahavira, the founder of Jainism, who was a contemporary of the Buddha, and several other teachers who are mentioned in the Pali text, who were also exploring new ideas, that were teaching their doctrines and their forms of meditation practice. But there was something about what the Buddha said that seemed to strike a chord, that seemed to resonate with the needs and the aspirations of people living in this turbulent time and place. And I've run out of time, so I'm going to leave that here. That's very much the backdrop. And tomorrow morning, I'll go into more detail as to what it was that the Buddha taught that differentiated, that distinguished his teaching, his Dhamma, from that of the other teachers, and particularly the Brahmanic tradition of his period. We're now going to have a period of walking meditation for the next half an hour. I suspect most of you are quite familiar with this practice, am I correct? Yes. I'll just give a few very brief suggestions. Try and find a place where you have about 10 meters, 15 meters from about there to there, and just slowly walk up and down. It's useful to begin by standing still, feeling the pressure of your body on the ground through your feet, feeling the breeze against your skin, the sounds that are around you. And when you feel centered, then slowly walking back and forth, as fully conscious as you can be of what it is like to be walking. The pressure of your feet as they are placed and raised and moved, the way in which your body swings or moves as you walk, the rush of colors and shapes that is visible in the field of vision. But concentrating, I would say, initially on the physical sensations that accompany the act of walking. So we'll do that for half an hour, and then there'll be a bell, and we'll meet back here, and Martin will give some suggestions, some reflections on the practice of meditation as we will be doing it over the next couple of days. Thank you.